pretty drunk by now.
This is
Pop Culture Yearbook. On this show, we pick pieces of pop culture that were important to us in a given year. We then discuss memories and dig into those movies, albums, shows, and more. I'm Brad.
I'm Pete.
I'm Giff.
You did it.
And I'm Dave.
Oh, there he is. He got his cue. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Still here.
All right, we are ripping through this great month. Last week was probably the best 2 hours of my life talking about Three Amigos with you guys.
Wow.
I mean, it was pretty fun.
That's hot praise.
I hope people found it fun to listen to.
The best 2 hours of your life. Wow.
Well, you know, that's called hyperbole, Pete.
Yeah, ooh, look at that. Okay. You're bringing the big words this week.
Yeah, well, you know, I am an English teacher. So we had our fun last week with that one. And the rest of this month, as we've said, has all pretty much been designed by our wonderful, wonderful friend Dave, who introduced us to his favorite movie of all time, Big Trouble in Little China, 2 weeks ago. And now tonight, we're going to hear about one of his favorite people. So I won't say anything more, and I'll just let him take it from there.
Yeah, so tonight's movie is Stand By Me. And, you know, with this, Amigos and Big Trouble in Little China, originally when we were talking about doing this, I kind of laid out a little map of like at each year, what would I want to throw out there as an assignment. And I remember when I made my list for 86, I was like, oh man, this is like picking your favorite kid. Like, I love all three of these movies.
Oh, I got
and
it.
Which is part of why
88 next month. And I don't even know what I'm going to do.
It's
impossible.
Well, and so that was the thing is, so a while back, Brad, I had told you, I'm like, hey, you know, if I could come on and, I definitely like doing movies more than music, and we could do these three. And then I thought it would be kind of fun to add on another one that's 10 years later that, you know, I've always wanted to talk about too, which we'll get to next week. But as I think about this movie, so this came out in August of 86. I've really enjoyed looking at the box office for all these movies because mm-hmm. box office back then was so different and so weird. This came out for a couple of weeks in a limited release. I probably saw it on the week of 8/22. It made like 4 million, just under 4 million that week. It ended at 52. So it kind of like its real opening week made 3.8 million, but it just stuck around forever. And that's mm-hmm. what I thought was so kind of cool about all these movies was it just was a different this time.
And wondering about how they marketed it too. Maybe we'll get into that in a minute because it's rated R and I'm like, wait a little bit
of, I know that I went to go see this. I can't remember what my motivation was, but I do remember I did see this in the theater. And I remember that when I was in there and seeing the credits, I was surprised to see that it was based on a Stephen King story called The Body.
Did we ever name this movie?
Yeah. What's that?
Did we ever name this movie? He did. Okay. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah.
You did. Yes.
I did. It's Stand By Me.
My apologies.
And so The Body is the name of the Stephen King story. And at the time, I'm sitting there as an 11-year-old. I had a pretty strong like awareness of Stephen King at this point. My guess is I might have read one of his books. I have an idea of what my first book was that I read of his. I for sure had seen a few of his movies, and that'll kind of come up in my list at the end of the show where we do top five things that are based on Stephen King. Mm-hmm. But so that kind of intrigued me. But Brad, when you're saying about how this was marketed, I think they specifically, and I've listened to a couple of things, I think they specifically kind of stayed away from the Stephen King branding because at that point he was known as like a horror guy.
Right. Well, that's true. But mm-hmm. I was thinking more, it's rated R and it's about 12-year-olds.
Right.
And like why would somebody want to go see that unless it got, you know, this great buzz? Like, it would be kids that would want to watch this movie, and it's rated R.
So I think
I'm not exactly sure why it was rated R in the first place.
Time in that I know that I wouldn't have, like, I don't think I would have gone to this with my parents. I think it was just when you were a kid back then, you could go to a rated, like, at least up in Morehead. I don't think they were like, you know, no, you can't go to this.
There's no morals in Morehead.
Yeah. Well, Moorhead's very Wild Wild West. I mean, it was kind of that way just my whole childhood. But that actually, what you're talking about, Brad, kind of goes to, so I've told you guys before that, like, at this stage in my life, I'm testing things out. I'm hanging out over at the elementary school late into the night, talking major trash. And I loved the idea that this was like four kids. Yeah. You know, it's a period movie, right? So it's set,
like us,
in the,
basically.
It's set in 1959, but it's they're talking in a way that I wanted to be talking with my friends, yeah. Right? And not that I was a smoker. And actually, my kids, when I showed this to them, they're like, "Wow, they're all smoking." And I'm like, "Yeah, it's kind of, that was a thing." Mm-hmm. But anyway, so. With this movie, if I think about that, that was the main thing that appealed to me when I was a kid. There's an obvious scene in here that, so if I think about what I love about it now versus what I love about it as a kid, the thing that I walked away out of the theater, I'm sure, talking about is not even something that's really a big part of the movie for me anymore. And that might be pretty obvious of what that is. But then the only other thing I'll say there is, with Stephen King, so when I did find out, last thing I'll say on, I last week we had a list of things that you couldn't wait to show your kids. Mm-hmm. I took this one off at the last minute to put Karate Kid in. To me, I find this to be, I think this is one of the best coming of age movies, and it's probably my favorite coming of age movie. I did want to show my kids this. I was probably a little more excited to show them Karate Kid because I knew that would really register. This of the three movies that we've talked about, I was probably the most kind of internally let down in that my kids just didn't love it the same way I do. And I kind of get that. It's based in the 50s. It's a weird, hard sell.
And that goes back to what I was saying too, is that,
what's that?
It's like, The Karate Kid is one you would sit down and watch with your kids as a family. This isn't really like a family movie where you're going to sit down. Again, I can't imagine who was going into the movie theater to watch it. It just doesn't quite add up.
But there's,
they wouldn't make it PG-13.
There are reasons why. And actually, so like the whole, we'll get into it when we get into the movie, but how Gordy is as a character and what kind of Gordy's struggling with. Mm-hmm. That honestly was a big part, and it's part of what I love. It's my favorite part of the movie now, and that whole thing was like really was my main thing of like wanting to watch this with them, because it's so much about like you should not be ashamed to be who you are, and that's what I love about Chris and Gordy's relationship. But anyway, so let's get to, because I do have a list on the front end of this, and it is. So I told you guys that this guy is on my, what I call Man Crush Mount Rushmore. Man Crush More. And so I'm going to give a couple of just quick stats to show that I am a certified, like, Stephen King fan. And so, you know, he's, for anybody that doesn't know, I mean, he's a super prolific writer. And his stuff has been all over pop culture. If I look at it, the span of his career, his first book was Carrie in 1974. This last year, he released a book called Fairy Tale that was released in 2022. Over that span, he's released 82 books. Now, this is all off of Wikipedia, and I eliminated a couple of things that I thought sounded kind of like, I'm like, I don't know about that. So I put it at 82. The Wikipedia number was a little higher. Of that, I've read 50 of those books. If you add up all the pages, and again, Wikipedia, so I don't know the accuracy, that's 38,039 pages, of which I have read 25,281 of those.
Wow.
And if I, like, so if I think about books like The Stand, It, Under the Dome, like all these books are 1,000+ pages. I'll get into a little. So this is actually one of the things I do with my kids. I have been reading to them. We started back when they were early elementary, read all the Harry Potters. And the minute I was done with all the Harry Potters and we loved it so much, I thought, what's next? And we've just been going and going and going. And over time, as they got a little older, I've sprinkled in some Stephen King, and that is going to affect my last list. But anyway, so
the number of pages you read is really impressive when you realize that Gifford has not yet hit 100 pages of any book in his life.
That's correct.
That's correct.
Well,
well, if you count like Penthouse magazines or some stuff like that.
I don't look at those for the articles.
Yeah, he didn't read any.
Well, that counts.
Sometimes I'm the opposite
of the guy. Yes, the storyline.
Turn ons.
Yeah, I'm the opposite of the guy.
He can read the word turn on
for the articles. No.
Long walks in the park.
So yes, well, and actually, of those 25,281, I'll tell you right now, I'm guessing it's probably up in the 5,000 to 6,000 of ones that I've read again, as well. Sure.
Yep.
You know, because well, and part of it is his biggest book series I've read twice because I read it to my kids, and that one probably clocks in at about 5,000, 6,000 pages on its own. But a couple of things real quick before we jump into the Man Crush Mount Rushmore, and it will show in this movie the things that Stephen King is kind of known for outside of, like, you know, a lot of people think of like Christine or Cujo, The Shining, things like that, where they think like it's like all horror with like a, you know, kind of like a supernatural vibe. But what he truly, I think, writes really well, he writes kids really well. I think he's really good about writing about how innocent kids are. He really writes bullies well. We'll get, and so to me, a lot of what his strengths are really play out in this book. Funny thing about this book is I read it once shortly after I saw this. Didn't really care for it that much. It's part of a collection that also includes one of his other biggest movies, Shawshank Redemption. Yep. Both stories don't do much for me at all, whereas the movies are two of my favorite movies of all time.
Those are both novellas, aren't they? Isn't that what they call them?
It's in a collection called Different Seasons. There's four stories. Each one is a different season. These are the two most well-known ones. There's another one where a movie's based on it. It's called Apt Pupil, which is a really messed up story.
In the list that you sent us of all the Stephen King things, there was no Shawshank Redemption on that list.
That's in Different Seasons.
Yep.
So yeah, Rita Hayworth. You didn't tell me that, so.
Oh, sorry. Did you not know that Shawshank is a?
Well, I guess I probably did know it, but I didn't realize it, and I was just going purely off the list.
I did my own research, and I found I did my own research.
My bad. I didn't call that out specifically. No.
Do your own research.
Pete did his own research. Now, whether or not any of that research is accurate, we'll find out.
Yeah, this is the guy who found Breaking Bad in the office.
Put in the work.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so here it is. Here it is, guys, and I will kick it off.
Okay.
So Man Crush Mount Rushmore. These are the guys that, like, have defined my pop culture experience. These are the four horsemen. Stephen King's one of them. Randy Moss is another. And we've talked about all four of these guys on the show. But so Randy Moss, there's nothing that will ever compare to my experience of the 98 season and just this supernova blowing up. We feel invincible. And then I don't care about all the shenanigans later. If anything, that kind of helps with it. Like the whole straight cash homie, I'll play when I want to play. There was just something about him, like, nothing will ever compare. My other two, one is Dave Grohl, two is Andy Samberg.
I could, yep, those all make right. All make sense to me.
Those are the guys
for you. Absolutely. I like these guys.
I like these. Right. They're funny.
They're funny guys.
They're funny guys.
Still one of them.
Oh, don't do that though.
Don't do that. No. I could go next if you don't mind.
Sure.
All right. So I really enjoyed this assignment, Dave, because putting together a Mount Rushmore. I had a Mount Rushmore, you know, made up of a few individuals in the past, mainly Bill Cosby, Kevin Spacey, Mel Gibson, and until last year, Will Smith. So,
welcome to the canceled podcast. You just won the episode.
In order to build a new Man Crushmore, this is a good assignment for me. So, I kind of split it up by genre. So, I went for TV, I went with Jon Stewart. Loved watching The Daily Show all those years. For music, Garth Brooks would be on my Mount Rushmore. For sports, Magic Johnson. Yes. Without a doubt, my favorite sports guy growing up. And then for movies, this was a little tougher for me, but I think I'm going to settle on Vince Vaughn. I love watching anything that he's in. And and according to one drummer and one band, I'm him. So I like Vince Vaughn. So those would be my four.
That's a good list.
Thank you.
Beautiful.
That's a good list too, no?
All right, I can go next. My line item number one, I actually had two, but they go together.
All right.
And you're gonna totally understand when you hear them. I have Dave Grohl / Taylor Hawkins. Because either one of those guys, like if I could trade places, you know, with living their life. I mean, obviously Taylor Hawkins is no longer with us, but you get what I mean. But I thought I just think that they're both the most awesome guys. We've talked a lot about them, of course, on the show. My next one might be a little bit of a surprise, but it kind of makes sense just because I love this guy's personality. I think he's got the, you know, he's a fairly pretty big star, but it seems like he is always true to who he is. And I just love his personality, Jason Bateman. My number three, I've said before, I'm going with sports here on this one, but is also going to be a little surprise. The obvious one might have been Randy Moss or Kirby Puckett or something like that. I actually went with Jim Thome. He was one of my favorite just ball players. I loved him when he was with, you know, the Indians and the other teams that he played with. I'd always said that he was my favorite player who wasn't a Twin, and then he became a Twin, and it was great.
It's like me with Russell Wilson, if Russell Wilson would have been a Viking.
That's right. That's right.
Kirby Puckett is cursing you from his grave right now.
Yeah, he is.
I just loved him. But by all accounts, Jim Thome is just super great guy. A really nice guy. I actually met him once just briefly at like Twins Fest. You know, it wasn't really anything to talk about, any exchange. He just said hi, I think, and whatever. But
great story.
But just, you know, he was fun to watch, just the bombs that he would hit.
Hey, by the way, and I saw the greatest home run that he ever hit in the first year at Target Field there.
Oh, the one off the flagpole?
And it is still, no, it was the end of the White Sox game.
That was against the White Sox.
Yeah, but it didn't hit the flag, but it was just, it was out by it.
Okay.
But it was the most awesome home run I've ever seen in person. Well, I shouldn't say that because it's second Herbert's Grand Slam. But the view I had of this was, and the game, it was pretty awesome. Unforgettable.
I actually was at a Twins game with my dad and my wife. We went when they played against the Indians, and Thome was playing for the Indians, and the Twins won in like a record-breaking blowout. It was like 23-3. Or something like that. It's like the most runs the Twins have ever scored. And we were sitting up in right field. And Thome was with the Indians, and they had only scored three runs. But the two of the three runs were solo home runs. And they both hit the white curtain in the Metrodome, like the upper deck, when they had those white, big white, dusty curtains up there.
With Brad pitching.
Yeah, exactly.
he like defines farm boy strong.
Yeah.
He's that's like, what I love
like
about
Casey him. At the bat in
well,
the
he's like modern Babe Ruth. How about that?
Yeah, or like the stories about him are very similar to like we never saw him play, but Harmon Killebrew, right? I mean,
very comparable to Harmon Killebrew. Yeah. And I just thought he was great. And then my number four was Jerry Seinfeld. I just think that he is obviously he's the perfect comedian. I love stand-up comedy, and he is the king of the whole, that whole occupation. So
for sure, that's a great list.
That's my list. Thank you.
All right. Brad? That leaves me, huh?
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, I think you guys can all know who my number one is going to be right off the bat. The George Washington of my man crush more.
Steve Martin.
Steve Martin. Mm-hmm.
I could have put that, but I didn't want to because I knew that you were going to have him.
So we've done an episode on L.A. Story and talked plenty about him. Go listen to it. He is the greatest. And it's not just acting. It's just so many things that he does. Yeah. So, yeah, I do have one that I knew would be, it's been tripled up now. Garth Brooks ruined the deal here, but we got Dave Grohl is on my list, of course, too. Otherwise, we would add four of the same musician. There's no one cooler than Dave Grohl. And of all the shit he's been around, I mean, he seems like he is just totally normal and cool. And I mean, I'm sure he's not perfect, but he comes across as just the coolest guy ever. Mm-hmm. I do have another musician on here because the original Dave Grohl for me, Dave, was Chris Isaak.
I figured Steve Martin and Chris Isaak were going to be on here.
Chris Isaak is just another guy who is just cool as can be, and his concerts are great, and his music is great, and he's been on TV. He can do it all, too, and I just love that guy. And it wasn't just like, you know, two albums. I mean, he went on forever, and he's been a big part of my life. And then I didn't have an athlete on here at first, but I realized today that I could, and it made for a better fourth spot. And I'm pretty sure you can figure this out, too, if you're sitting there and you know me. But my favorite athlete of all time, not the greatest twin of all time, although he's the most underrated twin of all time, and that is Shane Mack.
Shane Mack.
And I have never enjoyed watching a guy play baseball and rooted harder for a guy than him. And he kind of disappeared into nowhere when he retired. But Japan, I've never heard about him beating a wife. I've never heard about him going to jail. So hopefully he's just living his life. And just doing it out there, and is a good guy.
Are you waiting for the return of the Mac? Is that what you're looking for?
Oh, my God.
I do have a list of some honorable mentions. I didn't know if we were going to be doing that, so I can just run through quick.
Like Jerry Seinfeld would totally be on my
list. Oh, good one.
Seinfeld would have been my second TV guy.
He should be on my list. I totally forgot about him. I have Paul Rudd. He's the guy I took out for Shane Mack.
Yep.
I had Tom Hanks, you know, he's great. Who doesn't love him?
Yep.
I have Bill Hader. That guy is cool as all shit. De Niro was a big part of my growing up.
Oh, yeah.
The musician that you might think, since I love R.E.M. so much, is Michael Stipe, but I actually have Mike Mills on my list because he's seems like the cool guy of that group. I have Harry Styles on my list because he is a cool MF-er. No, he is. Dave will attest to that.
You're like a little millennial, Brad.
No.
Little millennial.
That's his movie. I added one other. Little millennial. He wouldn't really be a man crush, but listen to this list of movies this guy directed in a row. And a lot would start with Spinal Tap, but I didn't see that at the time. The Sure Thing, we talked about. Stand By Me, The Princess Bride, When Harry Met Sally, Misery, and A Few Good Men. In a row, who's that director?
Robert.
I mean, that is a list of like some of the most defining movies of my life growing up. And that is just incredible in a row. So, he was always like a cool, fun guy too to see talk. He was always just fun loving guy. And then Meathead, of course.
Yeah.
And all the family.
When you were going to say a director, if it wasn't him, I was going to say that might be a good segue into the movie I've heard it said this way between Stand By Me, Princess Bride, Misery.
When Harry Met Sally.
Well, and you mentioned A Few Good Men, but in all those cases, you could say that those are the gold standard for the type of movie that they are, right?
Correct. Mm-hmm.
When Harry Met Sally is the romantic
comedy. The romantic comedy, yeah.
You know, Princess Bride is the, you know,
perfect
fantasy family movie.
It's the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so... And I do like there's actually a movie that I've mentioned before. It's, you know, I obviously have my things I go back to all the time, but I won't bring it up here. But it's another coming of age movie that to me, this one and that one, there's a link between them. And they're by far my two favorite, like, coming of age movies. And so, yeah, I wouldn't have thought of him that way growing up. Because you had other flashier directors and all that. But if I look back at the stuff he's done, it's pretty freaking amazing.
Yeah. And plus, he's just the kind of guy that looks like he'd be cool to hang out with and fun. Like, he's a normal, like, cool guy.
Well, so what I think is kind of funny about that is my impression of Rob Reiner is unfortunately somewhat tainted because he is the butt of a very, very funny South Park episode that's all about trying to ban smoking. And, you know, the joke is that Rob Reiner is this like California liberal that's trying to like make sure that nobody can smoke.
Okay.
Even though, and then so the joke in there is that they have Rob Reiner constantly eating things, talking about, you know, other people's health.
So South Park ruined him like the 40-year-old version tried to ruin Coldplay.
So if we were going to talk about short lists of man crushes, Matt and Trey would be, they'd be a ways down, but they'd be on my list.
They'd be on there.
Well, they're pretty fun too.
Yep.
So, the one I had that I strongly considered and could have just as easily been on my list, David Letterman. Yeah. I absolutely
love him.
I just thought, I love Letterman. I thought that his show was just comfort TV at the end of every day. And now I like his show that's on Netflix. That's pretty good. Yep. And I think he's another guy that I think he's true to who he is. And he's just a super, super genuine, nice guy that you could just sit down and have a beer with. And it would be totally cool.
I kind of view, like, in the new crop, the guy that reminds me most of him is Kimmel. Kimmel's definitely got like a Stern vibe to him too. But in what you were saying, where of the most, when it came to like casual conversation, I thought Letterman was the best back then. I think Kimmel's the best when it comes to that now, of kind of being himself and just, you know, unfortunately too much like late night TV now is just too much like set up anecdotes and
they're trying to get on TikTok and YouTube and whatever. Sure. That's all they're going for.
I'm glad you brought up Jerry Seinfeld though, because I totally blanked on that and he would be my next one.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, if I were given a fifth, I would have to go probably with Michael Keaton.
That is a great choice.
He should be Mr. Mom.
Yeah. Well, and Beetlejuice and the stuff that he's done. Yeah.
His comeback here in the last 10 years has just been awesome.
It's just been amazing. So he's always high on my list as well.
Wow.
So, I mean, nice who call. Can forget him in The Other Guys, quoting TLC the entire
Exactly. Movie. Don't go chasing waterfalls. Creep.
His little cameo in the movie Out of Sight is still just one of the best things, too.
Yeah. Yep.
He's barely in it, but.
Yeah.
Well, so do you guys want to jump into the movie then?
Yeah, why don't we talk about this movie?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Well, so I'll go through, you know, I'll kind of hit like the highlights as we're going through. If anything you guys want to jump into.
Oh, here. So you asked us before if we had any real memories, and I think we all kind of said no. But the one memory I did have right when I turned it on was the soundtrack.
Yeah. Yeah.
This was a soundtrack on cassette tape that I listened to over and over and loved those 50 songs. So that was my memory. And that's what I had even more. I knew the movie, but I had more experience with the soundtrack as a kid.
I did love.
I was going to talk about this later, but as long as you brought that up, it's to me, it really introduced me to a lot of like oldies type 50s music. And I don't remember really ever hearing about Buddy Holly before this came along. And that song that's on that soundtrack was great. I fell in love with Buddy Holly as a result of that. And then it had some of the other hits that were quote unquote bigger hits at the time that tape came out. Like Lollipop, I think, was the biggest one that the kids all did on the bus and stuff. Yep. There's some of the other fun ones.
We had the Time Life tapes too, so this was like another one of them. It was like one that fit right in with all of those, and I would listen to those all the time as a kid.
And I'm not much of an oldies guy, so like the music in the movie I liked, and how it was used in the movie, it's not anything I ever really went back to much. I do love. The scene that I love best when it comes to the music in there, it is, and this gets to the whole Rob Reiner thing. I can't remember what it transitions off of, but when they're, I think it's coming off of a scene with the older kids, and they go to Vern and Teddy going down the train track singing Lollipop, and they do the little, you know, pop of the cheek and everything. And I thought that was so great, but But yeah, that, I don't know, like the music for whatever reason never really resonated too much with me. And I think it just, I think it was just my preferences. I was a hair metal guy back then. And, you know,
sure. Well, some of us were just a little more diverse.
Yeah, hey, Dave. That's fine. I'll take it. I'm a heathen.
He was a hair metal guy going to R-rated movies as a 12-year-old in Moorhead, yep. Minnesota.
Right, right. And about a year or two away from listening to a lot of gangster rap. So, yep. You know.
It's meanwhile, right. Brad and I are dressed up as like 1950s.
Yeah, or as a hobo.
Or as a hobo. Yeah.
Trick or treat.
Reading a Garfield book, dressed as a hobo, and listening to Lollipop.
Yep. Picture that.
So at the beginning of the movie, they you know, they introduce Richard Dreyfuss. You know, he's obviously Gordy grown up. He's thinking in the Jeep. And they set it up right away that he was 12 going on 13 in 1959. At that point, you meet, well, and he's looked down and he's seen a newspaper headline that it says attorney Christopher Chambers, you know, slain in fatal, you know, restaurant accident or something like that. And I will say, as a kid, I didn't know the word attorney. And so I struggled on that, like of not, I didn't watch the movie the first time around for sure, knowing that like Chris is kind of doomed. And that's something where that's a very Stephen King thing, you know, and how he writes his stories is that he does a really good job of kind of like giving you something down the road that you're going to work up to. Right.
Yep.
But it, you know, it kind of sets things up and it's part of what so in the body, the story, the body is kind of the Chris is the main character, whereas the movie is very much it's Gordy and right. Gordy is kind of like the Stephen King stand in, right? The awkward kid. And a lot of this is kind of considered autobiographical. And so one thing I will say is that the movie, where do you guys think this movie was set?
In Oregon.
I thought it could have been, I mean, obviously, it was, I thought just like Midwest.
Any town USA.
I thought it could have just as easily been Tyler. Or Russell.
Right.
I forgot I was on mute. I said Oregon right away. Portland.
1,251 people.
But you guys say that because they mention Portland.
Right. It looks like it looks like Oregon too when they get out in the woods and stuff.
And the countryside, yeah. Very, very much so. That was a screenwriter, one of the people adapting this, was confused. Almost all of Stephen King's, especially his early stories, are all based in the Northeast. He's from Maine. And so he writes about Portland, Maine all the time. And Castle Rock is like the main.
That's right, Maine. And
they're
Stephen
from
King.
Castle Rock. But the movie is supposed to be in Oregon. So I thought that was kind of interesting, but anyway, so the first scene, and I think I've talked to you guys before about how I can't stand in current movies, like the heavy soundtrack, introduction of a bunch of different, like we're going to introduce 8 characters in 5 minutes and each one's going to have his own theme song. Like it drives me nuts. And, you know, so like movies like, because I think like they do that in Not Another Teen Movie, which as much as I love that movie, I can't stand that stuff of like, here's 30 seconds of a song that defines this character. And here's 30. This movie does such a good job of establishing the crew. They're up in the treehouse. 3 of them are playing cards. And that's another thing with these kids. And I thought that the kids in this movie are just amazing across the board.
Yeah. Yes.
They did something that I think is really hard to do, which is when you read Stephen King books, he uses like this kind of like weird 50, like even in more updated stories, he uses like weird slang and like very, you know, maybe that's the way like it is up in the upper Northeast, but like, Some of the lines like piss up a rope or a pile of shit has 1,000 eyes. Like those are the kind of things that he writes in the stories that I think in his mind, he thinks this sounds super funny. and it's weird.
Right.
You know, but this is a good example of they sell the dialogue, you know, because it never, in my opinion, it never comes off as like, oh, what are these guys?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
But then in the way they introduce it, so you got Teddy and Chris are playing cards and arguing, you know, Chris is telling a joke that's offending Teddy, but then all of a sudden you hear the knock. That's not the secret knock.
Mm-hmm.
You know, oh, come on, guys, I forgot the secret knock. And they all look at each other. Burn. It's like Norm from Cheers.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. You know, so you've like, to me, Rob Reiner did such a good job of like already establishing the, jeez, you know, the hierarchy,
the different characters. Yes. Yeah.
Yes. You know,
yep.
And everything. And in such a way of like, that was natural to kids. And, you know, and you obviously have Richard Dreyfuss that's jumping in and narrating too. I will say that Richard Dreyfuss can't compete with like a Morgan Freeman when it comes to narration voice.
I was thinking that actually a couple of times too. First of all, I had forgotten, I hadn't seen this movie in many, many years, maybe 25 to 30 years. I had forgotten that was Richard Dreyfuss. And maybe when I had first saw it, I didn't even know really who Richard Dreyfuss was. Sure. As well. But I thought the same thing too, is that the narration wasn't quite as crisp as I kept trying to compare it to the Wonder Years, right? And it had that kind of voiceover, but it wasn't quite, didn't quite hit as home.
His voice is a little too nasally.
Yes. Yes. Maybe that's it.
Yeah.
Dave, and here he comes with the impressions again.
Hey, I was 12 going on 13 when I moved to
Castle. Town is getting too rough for me.
No, if we could have only had Fred Asparagus.
If Fred Asparagus would have been great.
I was living in Castle Rock.
So that's where you get the big line that sets up the whole movie, which is, you guys want to go see a dead body.
Yep.
Right. And they all get serious. And that, I have to say, Brad, when you're saying like, who is this for? I don't even know if I went to this movie knowing that was what the journey was about. And I have to like, that part of the journey, that wouldn't have appealed to me as a kid. Like if that would have been me and my friends sitting around, I wouldn't have been like, oh, what? There's a kid they're looking for and we know where he is. Like, but none of that mattered because I was already all in on like, I like these kids and I want to hang out with them.
Well, the one thing I will say that is kind of a universal appeal is, I don't know if they were necessarily interested in seeing the dead body so much as getting the reward of being in the paper, and
they wanted to be famous,
which honestly today that's all kids think about is, you know, they're being TikTok famous.
Nowadays they would have just done a TikTok. They'd have done selfies with the body.
Right. Exactly. So, you know, I mean, that part of it as a 12-year-old, it's like, oh, I could be in the newspaper. Oh, like we're going to be on TV. We're going to be stars. So I think that was the big impetus. It wasn't necessarily the macabre side of us going to see a dead body.
Right. Right.
I think the idea of it the idea of finding that dead body sound, it's one of those that to kids that age sounds really cool at first, but then obviously when they actually find it, just the reality.
Well, totally, and that hits them. Yeah. And that totally plays out in the movie. Right. Because when they do see it, and that was one of those, it kind of hit me as like, oh, you know, this was what this was all about when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, it really, that finality of death hits them, right? And it is something that you know, it's tough to think about when you're a kid. So at the end of that, though, when Vern tells them how he knows, they do the little flashback to him trying to find his pennies.
Yep, his pennies.
And which I love because that's totally Vern and his character in this. And so I love that. And to me, there's things in this movie that are comic that are very subtle. Like that's one of those things where it's not like a gross out gag. It's not whatever. It's just like, you love the idea of this sad kid who can't find his pennies.
Right.
And it lines up so well with his goodbye as he's walking away. He finds one in the street. Penny. Yep. You know, and it just so and that kind of is a through line for him with a handful of things. And I love Jerry O'Connell in this movie. You know, and really all of them, they're all so good.
And that moment was just perfectly placed when he's walking away. Everybody else is just like downtrodden. They're worn out. They're tired. They're still in shock from having seen the body. But then, Vern just sort of,
Penny,
you know, he puts a bright spot on that whole ending.
Yeah. So then after that, then it goes right to then Gordy kind of, you know, and so you're learning about these guys, right? And so Gordy, it's all, he's now the invisible boy at home, and you see the dynamic with his parents. And, you know, that wasn't something I could relate to of like, you know, I did not have cold parents or anything like that. But for me, I will say, like, I've watched this probably 3 or 4 times since the girls have been born. And I blubber every time at this scene when he has the flashback of, you know, with the Yankee cap with Denny. And, you know, John Cusack plays Denny, his older brother, who's just recently died in a car crash. And his parents are very much telegraphing to him that they love Denny more than they loved him.
Oh, yeah.
The wrong kid died.
Especially that. Especially with his dad. But that flashback where he gets, and it's so important for the next scene where you meet the bullies, but where he gets that Yankee cap and his brother is, you know, telling him how many fish he'll catch and everything. And it just, for me, that scene is so tough to watch because it reminds me so much of my relationship with Jenny, who, you know, my older sister who passed, who, even though we didn't always get along great, was very much a protector when I was younger. She was 4 years older than me. And like there were actually, I mean, I have a very kind of traumatic physical altercation that happened to me when I was about a little older than these kids in the movie, that where she like basically whooped the crap out of somebody who put me in the hospital, you know, for a little bit. And so it is like, I just, you know, when I see that scene, it kind of gets me worked up. But anyway, so then they're going on the adventure. You find out they've got the gun. You know, Chris stole his dad's gun. And that's when you meet Ace and Eyeball being Chris's brother. And I got to tell you, like, Ace, Kiefer Sutherland, man, he is one of my favorite actors. Mm-hmm. And even though he is, to me, he's like Scar the Lion in this movie. He's so like, just slow and
wow, that's a good comparison.
Well, just
that is a really good comparison.
Around and like
he's Scar the Lion,
but he's never quick, right? Like
very deliberate, very
eyeball. Yeah. Your brother's got bad manners, you know, and all that, like all that stuff.
But you're waiting for him to just, you know, he's just a bad,
right?
Bad guy.
Well, and that's the thing is, so Stephen King, he really does write bullies well. This scene specifically, though, so there is this scene was almost kind of recreated in another movie I love, which is Boys in the Hood. John Singleton used the scene where they steal Ricky's football and Doughboy goes and fights that guy, gets his butt kicked. And it's because Ricky was given that football by his dad.
Right.
And John Singleton basically cited this. There's two cases where John Singleton took things from this movie and he put them in Boys in the Hood. But anyway, so then at that point now, you've got kind of everybody, all the main characters are then established. And what I love about when they walk away from that scene where Gordy has lost his hat, Chris didn't know how important it was to him. But what I love and their relationship, as they're walking away, they do that little thing where they kick each other in the butt, you know? And I just, it's little things like that that make me just love this movie. After that, now we're walking along. We're finding out what they brought. Vern brought a comb.
I brought a comb. I brought the comb. That's Courtney's favorite line of this whole movie.
Well, in which later when they're talking about how much money they brought, you know, what do I have to think about everything? I brought the comb. Right. What do you comb for? You don't even have any hair. Right.
And again, that goes back to wanting to look good for all the cameras after they find the body and tell the police about it.
Yeah.
Right.
Thinking ahead.
Well, and then so that's the thing is they you know they realize they haven't brought money. So Gordy brought $1.02, Teddy brought 60 cents, Chris had 68, and Vern had 7 cents. Mm-hmm. I haven't found my pennies yet. They're about to get off the train tracks, and that's when we find out that Teddy is crazy. Mm-hmm. He's gonna dodge the train. They don't, you know, they're all yelling for him to get off the tracks,
just and like the only beach one that comes up
there to pull him off is Chris. And that's when you find out kind of like Chris is. So I love the line at the end of the movie where Gordy says, Chris, who always made the best peace,
mm-hmm.
you know, so he's talking about even when Chris gets killed, all he was trying to do was be a peacemaker. And you see it in this where he's pulling Teddy off. He's saying, you know, stop being so crazy, but he won't let them go on until Teddy skins it.
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. till they make it right. And I love. Between that and the dynamic of how he's looking out for Gordy, that is the main reason why I wanted to show this to my kids is I love. So as we're going along, and I won't hit all the scenes, but as you're going along and you've got the scene where Gordy says to ask Chris, am I weird? That's the scene. Like when I watched this as an adult, that was the scene where I wanted to show this movie to my kids. I wanted them to hear Chris, this tough kid, basically say, like, sure, you're weird, but everyone's weird. And mm-hmm. then telling them, you need to be who you are. Like, do not let us drag you down. You know, so I as we're going along, that to me is the main dynamic that I love about this movie, is that you've got Chris, who you eventually learn's kind of got his own baggage and everything. But you've got this kid who's kind of looking out for this other kid. Who, you know, is not the toughest kid out there. Right. So at this point, we're almost to the gray or to the junkyard. But is there anything kind of in the early stages there that you guys want to call out?
Well, one quick thing is I mentioned in the episode two episodes ago things that we love but hesitate recommending. I brought up the movie Johnny B. Goode.
Yes,
where I thought this is where I learned what acting was, where you could take Michael Anthony Hall and turn him into a, you know, a great football player. And we have Cusack as one of his nerd buddies in 16 Candles. And now Cusack in this movie is the stud quarterback.
He's like the all-American quarterback. Right. Yes.
And he, great actor. Like you don't doubt for a second. He's the stud football player in the movie.
Right.
I love acting.
Well, he's kind of a sad sack and Better Off Dead as well, even though he's, I mean,
yeah.
He's a cool guy, but he's
not. Well, he's a nerd in 16 Candles, and he's
he's a pretty shy guy in The Sure Thing.
He's got that stature where he's tall enough, and he's a good-looking guy. Like, yeah, do you ever doubt that he could have been a
top-flight
high school quarterback? No.
Right. But you know, he also never doubted that he was the ultimate nerd in 16 Candles either.
Right.
Good acting.
Well, that ad here.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, you asked what else. There was one little line I wrote down that I thought was hilarious in this first part. I think it's in this part because it's where my notes are. But they're just sitting around talking, and they start talking about Annette and Annette's tits.
The A and the E are going around. This is when they're at the junkyard.
But and it's one thing. It's funny to hear him talk about that. But then all of a sudden, Jerry O'Connell just smiles and goes, "This really is a great time." Well, he's just so happy, and that's great.
Yeah.
They're all just sitting there. They're chucking rocks in that little tin can.
Mm-hmm.
But even there, so then they all start spitting water in there. And at the very end, instead of spitting at the can, turns and spits in Vern's face.
Right in Vern's
face. And, you know, oh, great, spit at the fat kid, you know.
And by the way, the Annette is Annette Funicello from the Mickey Mouse Club. It's the reference here that...
Yes.
I am old enough to understand and get while watching this.
I wondered when I heard that line, is that the same Annette that is referred to in Grease? I always wondered.
Sure. I don't think so.
Well, okay. maybe.
There's one of the songs they're singing in Greece, and yeah, there's
this Greece set. I was saying set in the '50s, though. So,
right,
yeah,
but yeah.
I don't know 50s, what song you're talking about. So,
anyway,
The one thing I want to point out, you know, in the group of bullies, like Kiefer Sutherland's buddies, there was that really super thin blonde guy. I kept watching, like, what have I seen him before in?
Did you figure it out?
Did you guys recognize him?
I recognize him. I don't know where he's from.
He's Dave from Summer School, and he's in next week's movie.
Is he?
Oh.
He's one of the gang in Fear.
And he's also, what I found was that he's in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles as well.
Oh, yeah. He steals
guy that robs the hotel.
Yep.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Oh, that's what it is.
That's what I found.
Ah.
But if you guys remember in Summer School, Chainsaw and Dave, the two guys that are obsessed with the Texas Chainsaw Massacre,
yep.
He's Dave, the blonde one. So
yep. He was also in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. And the movie Ruthless People. Do you remember that movie?
Yes.
Judge Reinhold and
Bette Midler in that.
Danny DeVito.
Bette Midler and Danny DeVito.
Richard Dreyfuss in that, actually?
I don't remember him being in it.
I know it's Danny DeVito.
Danny DeVito, okay, maybe.
Reinhold. I don't know about Dreyfuss.
Probably not then.
Okay.
Moving on.
Well, never mind.
And so at this point, they're at the junkyard, and they got to go. Somebody's got to go get the food.
Yep.
And they do the flip. And I love when they do the flip, and Vern, they all get the same one. And Vern's like, oh, man, that's a Goocher, you know, and all that. And Feldman being like, nobody believes in moons and Goochers. It's baby stuff, you know, and all that. But that like all that stuff is so that
12-year-old-ish.
Right. Yes. And so they're all so good at what they, you know, and well, so anyway, so Gordy's the one who has to go. He goes and he has his second flashback about his brother because the guy who's selling him the food has seen his brother play football. You have this flashback where Gordy is at dinner and no one's paying attention to him because his dad is riding his brother about, you know, not losing focus. And
I was wondering when Denny was just going to turn to him and go, I don't want
Your life.
Yeah, but that never came. Well, and that's the thing, again, like you were talking about, how not only do his parents look down on him as not being good enough, but then people in the community as well, because about how, you know, this guy's talking about how great his brother was, and then asked him, do you play football? Or basically in you know, terms of, are you worth anything?
Yeah. And what, like, and he goes, well, what do you do? And, you know, and all that.
Nothing.
And yeah. And that's the thing is Chris is always like, you're going to be an amazing writer and everything. And even at one point he's like, you know, fuck writing. I hate writing. It's stupid. And he's like, that's your dad talking.
Right.
You know, and all that. And when he does that whole, I know how your dad feels about you. He doesn't give a shit about you, you know, and all that. And I love, like, this movie was one of the first movies where I thought, like, it kind of established the whole, it just kind of established the whole thing of, like, adults aren't always trustworthy,
right?
Mm-hmm. Between Gordy's dad, between what happens with Chris later with the teacher, like, that whole idea of, like, you need to protect and look out for yourself, you know, and...
Well, yep. I thought that kind of scene that you're talking about where two of them are walking in the front, and that is such a juxtaposition between adulthood and childhood, because you had the two of them were talking about, like, Superman versus Mighty Mouse, this kind of childish conversation, yes. Mm-hmm. While the other two are having that conversation that you just mentioned about, like, being a writer and how his father, you know, they had this very grown up, mature conversation. And that was kind of the overlap, and that was done several times throughout this movie perfectly.
Yeah, it was because Vern and Teddy are up front arguing if Superman could beat Mighty Mouse, and of course Superman would beat Mighty Mouse. He's a real guy. Mighty Mouse is a cartoon. You know? But I saw him juggling five elephants the other day. It's like, come on, Vern, you know, and all that. But yeah. So they when he gets back to the junkyard, that's when we've heard about Chopper. You know, he's all of a sudden he hears Chopper, Chopper, sick 'em boy, sick 'em. And he's like, now he said sick. Oh, I'll use my Dreyfus voice. Now he said sick 'em boy. But what I heard in my head was Chopper, sick ball,
sick ball. And this was my first like memory when I heard that line. I had forgotten it, but as a kid, I thought that was like the funniest line.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that was the first thing that like when I was watching it this time that I totally remembered and was like, oh yeah, that's right there.
Yep.
Well, and that, and so that's where I have to say, like, I didn't even understand the, I had such a fear of bigger dogs that like, even when he jumps over the fence and Chopper is sitting there and he's jumping at the fence and everything, and they're like, that's Chopper. They're all laughing at him. I was like, I don't know, man. I wouldn't want that dog jumping after me.
Right. Yeah. Me neither.
You know, or whatever, but it's the whole idea. And he said, that was my first introduction to the difference between, you know, myth and reality or whatever.
Right.
And all that.
Well, and it's a little bit like the Sandlot.
Right.
You know, with Bruce. Yeah.
Oh, for sure.
Wasn't
for
it Bruce? Sure. Is that the dog's name?
I don't know.
I don't remember that. I mean, I know what you're talking about as far as the movie, but
yeah.
I don't remember the dog's name.
Well, it was a very powerful scene, though, because that's what led to the scene with Teddy, right? They're arguing across the fence, and somebody mentioned about Normandy earlier, this is where he's talking about his dad and how he's loony, right?
Yep. And right, so, the junkyard guy is basically making fun of his dad for being crazy.
Right, right. Yep. And part of the reason, I mean, that this got really deep into the next, you know, few minutes of the movie with Teddy, because you could tell that Teddy looked up to his dad because he was at Normandy, but also was a little embarrassed by the fact that he, you know, probably went crazy because a lot of World War II soldiers, they had what they called shell shock back then.
Right.
Now they call it post-traumatic stress disorder. And so it had a lot to do with that, I thought.
Well, and that's where, you know, I mean, you see in the movie Teddy's mangled ear and how his dad almost burnt it off. And and then that's the thing is, as they're walking away, and I do think it's funny as Vern's obviously uncomfortable. He's trying to cheer them up and they're all like, shut up, Vern. But Gordy, well, and again, this is in narration, but Richard Dreyfuss says, you know, he can't believe how Teddy cares so much about his dad who almost killed him. And, you know, whereas he hates his dad who hasn't laid a hand on him since he was like five, and that was for eating bleach under the sink.
Right.
You know, and but it is that whole idea of like you, and there again, it's, you know, it's because he's attached. It's his dad. You don't want to hear something bad about your dad. At this point, they're going on. They have right before they settle in for the night, probably the most famous scene of the movie is the train dodge, or, you know, the train going over the bridge. And that is where we lose the comb.
Yeah.
Lost the comb.
Yep.
Forget it, Vern. But that, so I love right before they go out on the tracks, and I do have it written down. So, you know, they're discussing, well, should we walk further down, and that's too far and all that. And, you know, and Teddy's basically like, you guys can do whatever you want. I'm walking across here, and when you guys get back, I'll be on the other side, relaxing with my thoughts.
And do you, Vern, do that with Aaron, your...
And Gordy's like, do you use your right hand or your left hand for that? You wish. So, but yeah, this scene, and here again, so between the Chopper scene and this scene, Rob Reiner, there's both times when there's the chase, he does this little camera angle where you can see their feet, and it's just their feet running on, you know, like in the case of Gordy running through the through the junkyard, you just see his feet running through the junkyard. And it's the same on the train tracks. And it's so, like, I watch it now, and I mean, it's always, to me, a tense scene. There is something I always find funny now, though, as an adult. When I watch it, was there anything you guys thought was kind of odd about that scene?
Why didn't they just run across the bridge, or at least walk faster in the first place?
Well, they're, I mean, they're
kind of do. I was watching for that too. They kind of do walk faster.
Two,
I thought
Jerry O'Connell's on his hands and knees.
Right.
But because he's scared.
Yeah, but once they had to run, they could run totally fine. So just get across.
But to me, think about the whole idea of when you really think about how high up that train track is, and there are no rails on either side.
Yeah.
I got to be honest. I'm sure if I was on that thing, I would have like vertigo.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And so there's that. But there's something that I've always thought, like now when I watch it, I'm always like, what the hell? And it's how short the train is.
Oh
yeah. Yeah. And it was like an old timey engine. And it was, yeah.
It is the engine, a car, and the caboose. You know, and so
it still doesn't matter though. It's still gonna make you just as dead.
Gonna knock those boys out
pretty easy. You know. So, but now when I watch it, that always strikes me as kind of funny that it's just this little tiny train, you know, or whatever. But yeah, obviously they still would have. Right. And that's one where I do find River Phoenix is, you know, I think he's a pretty charismatic kid in this movie. And the whole hey. At least we know when the next train is due, right. You know, kind of thing is they're down there. And so, yeah. And then that's when they settle in for the night. And there's so many good things about like the nighttime discussion. So first of all, I love when they're cooking the hamburger and Vern loses his in the fire. And he's like, oh man, what am I supposed to do now? Why don't you cook your dick? Be a small meal.
Well, I was going to say, did this scene remind you of anything recently?
I can't think of anything. No.
The Three Amigos camp out scene.
Oh, yeah.
I was thinking right away when it came on. I'm like, hey, 2 weeks in a row.
Well, and when Vern gets it back, he stabs it out. He's like, ha, 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 I got it. Screw you guys. And all that. But then they do. They have their second kind of like Mickey Mouse Club type discussion as they're going around. One of my favorite comments in there is the, you know, Wagon Train's a really cool show, but they just keep wagon training.
Right.
and but all those little things in the whole, you know, what the hell is Goofy and all that.
Mm-hmm. That was pretty good.
Yep.
But then that's where it gets into this scene where Gordy's got the story. They want Gordy to tell a story, and he tells the whole story of lard ass Davy Hogan.
Yeah.
What do you guys think of this scene?
This was the second memory that I had. Like then yes. I watched this scene, I'm like, oh yeah, I remember that distinctly and probably thought it was really funny as a kid, but it just seems like kind of a long thing to include, which I don't know.
And it just seems so strange that you'd have all the people in the crowd just like constantly making fun of him, like grown-ups making fun of him. And
yeah, like, but it kind of demonstrates the way that kids think,
the way the kids look at
his story, and how he's just sort of developing as a writer. And it even establishes that there was like no good ending to that story. And that's where Vern is like, then what happened?
Well, so hold on though. But that is what I love about in the movie. So to me, he did end it well.
Yeah, he ended it great.
Lard has got his perfect revenge, mm-hmm. a complete and total
bar for rum.
And then you just, you know, that's where you do the Costanza, like, that's it, folks. I'll see you later.
Leave on a high note.
Yeah.
And you walk out. But so that's the thing is, I find what my favorite, I know that that is the scene that I walked out of the theater as a kid going like, oh man, that was awesome.
Yep.
The scene doesn't do much for me. What I love more now are Teddy and Vern's reactions, where Teddy's like, then what happened? And he's like, oh, that sucks. Like, he should go home and shoot his dad. And like, he's got this like crazy scenario, right? And then Vern's like, well, I thought it was pretty good, but I do have one question. Did Lardass have to pay to get into the competition? No, Vern, they just let him in for free. Oh, that is a real good story, of course. To me, that there again, those are just classic like kid reactions, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So then they got they've got to watch, you know, post up for the night because they hear coyotes,
right?
And everything.
Who would give Vern a gun? He's going to shoot himself or one of the kids. Honest to God, that kid's jumpy.
Their safety with that gun is not great. And Vern flying all over the place. That's my favorite one of that. Teddy's is kind of funny or whatever, but yeah, Vern, like, moving at every little sound is great.
It's his Second Amendment right, Gifford.
Yeah, great. Yep.
But then that's, to me, this is probably, like, the most emotional scene of the movie, which is when Chris is you know, holding watch, and Gordy's got his nightmare where, you know, it's the nightmare where it's, he didn't cry at Denny's wedding, but, like, he knows that his dad wished it would have been him.
Right.
And that's where then they sit up, they have their discussion, and Gordy's like, hey, you should come with me and try to do the advanced classes. And Chris is like, no, I'm a low life Chambers kid. And he tells a story about stealing the milk money, but just maybe the teacher stole it back. Right. You know, and it was like, I don't think that hit me so much at the time as a kid of, like, understanding what that truly meant. I will say now, like, and especially with what I do, you know, as a teacher, you, every day you just see, like, how vulnerable kids can be, and, like, how people that would take advantage of that, like, how evil that is, you know, and it does, like, that scene rips me up every time I watch it now.
Well, and this is the scene in the movie where, you know, throughout the movie, you've got Chris always trying to build Gordy up, you know, and this is the scene where the tables are turned, where you see Chris's vulnerability and Gordy right there with him, be like, no, man, you're, like, you're good enough. You're smart enough. Like, you can, you know, you can do this. Like, get, you know, don't think of yourself in that regard. You know, you can be better and bigger than what you think you could be.
Yeah. And that reflects in the end of the movie too, right? Mm-hmm. Of that he does do that, you know, when he gives kind of the postmortems, you know, Chris did follow me into those classes and all that. And so, yeah, that to me, that's always one of the big moments in the movie. The next scene, that next actual scene, is where he's sitting there in the morning and he sees the deer.
Yep.
And I that's another one that always gets me.
Okay, explain it to me then. I don't, like, what's the significance of this scene and why doesn't he tell anybody he saw a deer? I don't get it.
I think it's just the idea. So first of all, and it's part of what I really love, you know, about Will Wheaton's performance in this, of he's just got that little look up at the deer. And it's just like, it's this moment of like, kind of like, you know, I guess for lack of a better term, like beauty, right? This deer just came out. It's just standing there. It's looking. And then all of a sudden it runs off. And how he even says it, it was on the tip of my tongue, but I decided to just keep it to myself.
And I thought that it was like on some level, it was like a connection with his brother. And I don't know why I thought that, but it was like that, like he just came out and had that kind of moment. And then, like you said, he runs off. And I thought that was why he felt like it was a moment of connectedness with his brother.
Well, and even with the world, right? Of like,
yeah. I thought that had something to do with it though.
And I just love how quiet the scene is. I love the look on the deer's face as it stands, you know, and then it runs off. They're walking away then in the morning. And that's another line I love, is that Jerry O'Connell's like, you know, geez, Gordy, couldn't you have gotten some breakfast food, like, you know, Twinkies or Pez or root beer? And he's like, sorry, Vern, a more experienced shopper probably could have gotten more with your 7 cents.
That's a great line.
But at that point, this is all kind of leading up to the, you know, them finding the body, them having the face off. So you're constantly cutting back to the bullies and how they're doing all these stupid things. They're playing mailbox baseball. They're getting tattoos. But eventually the kid, the two that found them, they kind of spill it. And now the bad guys are on their way. Yep. Right. They're heading through. The one last thing they hit before they find the body is the swamp.
Yep.
And this is one where I know Stephen King has interviewed about how this truly happened to him. Like, so what happens with Gordy happened to Stephen King. And this scene skeeves me out all the time.
Every time. This is the scene of the movie that I remembered more than any other.
This was the third one I remembered was the leeches.
Oh,
I had three distinct memories, and this was the third one.
I hated leeches. I used to go camping all the time as a kid with my dad. I hated leeches up until I was like a young adult. I would go fishing with my dad, and I could not stand to like use them to bait a hook.
Yeah.
Until I got into like my 20s. And this was
because of this movie, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, just the way they move too. How they can get like super long and then like fat, and you can't. Oh, they're all.
I remember once we were like on a camping trip at some little like Cass Lake or something. I remember me and Mandy went down to the lake to go swimming, and the water was clear enough where I could see. And honest to God, I think I saw damn near close to like a 12 to 14 inch leech
when they're
swimming through the water. Yep. I'm like, no, thank you.
Yep.
You know? And they skeeve me out. But anyway, so we'll get to the end here where they have the big face off. And here again, this is where, so they find the body. I remember seeing the body as a kid and being kind of like, I don't even know what to think of this. But they're sitting there, and Gordy's like, it should have, you know, why did you have to die? And he's, you know, he's more talking about Denny. Chris comes over and they're sitting there. But then the bullies show up and they have the face off. Ace has got, well, and so Chris's line, why don't you go home and fuck your mother some more? And Kiefer Sutherland is so menacing in how he just pulls the switchblade out. Looks at him and points it, and he's like, you're dead.
Right.
And it is like, it's so, he is so freaking scary in this movie. And even in the face off. So, you know, Gordy shoots the gun, you know, what are you going to do, kid? Shoot all of us? No, Ace, just you.
Right.
And the Gordy plays it perfectly to get them to back off.
Right. Right.
But think about this even. And even how we go, like, we're not going to forget about this if that's what you think. And then he just goes strutting off like Scar the freaking lion. Like, he walks away, not even looking back. And I'm like, oh, my God. Like, he gives me more of, like, I get more skeeved out by it now than I did even as a kid of, like, he's so freaking menacing in this movie.
Well, I mean, he plays chicken with a freaking truck.
Well,
and it does not faze him.
Doesn't faze him at all.
He runs over that beam.
Yeah.
It's like, just like it's nothing. It's like, how could that car have taken that? It would have been like hitting a speed bump at about 80 miles an hour, however fast he was driving.
I think even in the moments where, that's the thing, is even in the moments where it's just them, you get enough of like, even his whole crew is scared shitless of him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, you know? For sure.
And so, yeah, so, you know, that they have that whole standoff. They decide that they're just going to call an anonymous tip, and the boys walk home. And as they're saying goodbye, to me, this, the ending is so like kind of matter of fact, sad.
And that's just the way.
So I love the line where he says, like, Teddy and Vern just kind of moved out of their lives like busboys in a restaurant. Yep. You know, you eventually just kind of get to be faces in the crowd. And then, but he talks about how him and Chris did stay together, and Chris made it through, and Chris, you know, but now he, you know, we know that Chris is dead. This is the other tie to Boys in the Hood, where as Chris is walking away and he waves, he vanishes.
Yep. He fades.
Same as Doughboy.
Doughboy. Yep.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I mean, is there anything on that last bit there, guys, that you guys want to mention?
Well, I always kind of wondered if, like, Ace is what Teddy turns into. Because you see Ace with the chicken with the truck. You see Teddy with the chicken with the train. Like, the comparisons of just getting to a point of not giving a shit and just seeing how far you can push stuff.
But I think the difference there is that that Teddy didn't have. He's mean in a way that you're kind of like mean to the one guy you guys all pick on, right?
Sure.
Like he's mean to Vern in a two for flinching way, not in a, hey, you better do this or I'll whoop your ass kind of way.
Not sure. Going to hold a knife to him or anything like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you don't
like,
know. I mean, how far
have you Teddy kid... as? I view Teddy as like psychotically, like psychotic in a self-harm type way, not being nihilistic. Whereas sure. Ace is all about like, do not get in my way, I will kill you.
But you could argue that in a matter of 4 years in those formative years.
Oh, sure.
You could go from Teddy to an Ace.
Yes.
You know, if yeah, pushed, if pushed in the wrong direction.
Yeah. So the only comparison I'll make when it comes to like kind of how sad, because it did say like Teddy was like a, Teddy was in jail, went to jail at one point. He was doing odd jobs. Vern's a forklift operator and all that. To me, not so much in the movie The Green Mile, but in the book The Green Mile, and that's one I've read to my kids. When you hear kind of like, so one thing he does at the end, when they're all kind of, you know, realizing that they've got to put, oh my goodness.
Coffee.
What's it?
Coffee.
John Coffee. When they got to put Coffee to death, like at that point, Stephen King takes a moment in the book to talk about the lives that they're all going to go on to lead.
Mm-hmm.
And they all have kind of like really sad, bittersweet endings. And it does right before Coffee's actually executed. It really kind of like level sets this like mood of just sadness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I kind of always feel the same way when I hear how they all wound up in this movie.
Yep.
Yeah. So do you guys want to?
I had two comments is all left here.
Anyone else with a comment?
Yes.
The German
first one is
wait here.
If you played a drinking game where you had to drink every time they used an inappropriate word for that we would not hear in a movie today, you'd probably die.
Yeah.
A lot
between
of
the P's and the F's and the what's
R's.
The other one?
R.
The R, yeah, the R comes in at the end there too, right? Those, yep. There's three specific ones you don't hear much, but it's a lot. And I don't know why it's rated R, because that stuff, I don't even know if that was really considered bad at the time. So are there that many?
It's funny that we're talking about that, because
I think it's that much language is the only
I'd watch.
It has to be language. There's no other reason.
Right. It has to be. And I'd watched Raiders of the Lost Ark, as I told you guys mm-hmm. over the weekend. And I thought, and that's a rated PG movie. And that movie is way more violent. And
well, Temple
I would
of
say
Doom is the one that was
it yeah, is, but,
even
but
worse.
Raiders of the Lost Ark is too. And there's a lot of like gross, gory things going on there. But that one's PG and Stand By Me is
yeah, I know. I don't get it.
Temple of Doom famously is one of the two movies that brought about the PG-13 rating.
Yeah, right.
That and Gremlins.
We've talked
well, about and like I'm looking at IMDb right now, and there's a parent's guide for most movies, and they cover things like sex and nudity, violence and gore, profanity, alcohol, drugs and smoking, and frightening and intense scenes. And there's not one of those categories that's ranked higher than moderate. And it was still ranked R.
I think
crazy.
My guess is it's language, it's the fact that they're smoking. And then I think the stuff with Ace with the switchblade and here's the thing. And so for all the violence in Raiders of the Lost Ark, I find Ace threatening to put out Chris's eye with a cigarette way more disturbing than anything in Raiders Lost Ark.
Yeah.
And they do also show a dead body. That
real. So I take that back, by the way. The final scene of Raiders Lost Ark is
where this guy's face melts.
Yeah.
That's a little shocking. But
yeah,
it's
that
so
is a bit much now that I think about it.
It's so cartoonish when it happens, you know, whereas like you got a kid on the ground in the middle of the, you know, on the sidewalk, and you're going to put a cigarette design.
I think it's the reality. It's the reality of that violence. And then, that's the thing is like, even the kid at the end, like seeing the dead body,
yeah,
that's, you know, that can be considered disturbing.
Right. And that's where, that's the two, moderate, the highest settings would be the profanity and the frightening or intense scenes.
Right.
You know, otherwise, you know, there's really nothing else in there. There's no violence, really. You know, no. Alcohol and drugs, there's more smoking than you would consider violence.
And I do wonder how it was viewed, kids smoking right. that much.
Yeah. It'd have to be. Yeah. That would be about it.
But, all right.
I still have one comment.
Oh, one more comment?
God. Well, I had two. And
yep.
I love, it's not a line, but we see him typing his book at the end. And yes. Guys, yes. It says, I never had any friends like the ones I had when I was 12. Jesus, does anyone? And yeah. I like, that was the most emotional I got watching this movie, because two of my mm-hmm. friends when I was 12 are sitting right here. And mm-hmm. the only friend I really have hardly that's not from then is Dave. And he didn't come right. that much later. So... Yeah. I love that ending, and I love thinking about that, and how cool that is that we are all still friends.
Well, that's and true.
I thought about that too.
I watched this movie and I was thinking, because I watched it last night in prep for this, and I went to bed like just jealous of like Pete and Brad and Haken, you know, having that childhood like in town where you can get together. You guys talked about, you know, playing baseball in the summer, you know, just having every that pal around time in the summers. Like, I mean, I had a little bit of that, but you know, it was a little harder when you're out of town and you gotta, you know, even ride your bike in, you know, 5-6, if I got to your guys' place, it would have been 8-9 miles, you know, so it's not like I had that growing up. So
and that one summer where we went to go find a dead body.
Yes.
Hey, can I do want to throw out one last thing before we get into the top five list. And it's this. So this came out in 86 and it was about 59, right? So it was like 25 years ago. Could you imagine how much different if you did like a Stand By Me update today?
Which one did we just talked about this with a different movie? What was that?
So if you did like late 90s to today, for mm-hmm. childhood, because here's the thing is I'll get back to your question there, Brad, but here's the thing. This is what I'm saying. When I watched this movie, the whole idea of them going out for a couple of days and tenting out, because I feel like I probably could have done something close to that
mm-hmm.
in my childhood in the 80s. I don't feel like my 80s childhood was that much different.
Sure.
Yeah, right? I agree. It could have been very similar.
Whereas now, do you feel like a kid would watch a movie? Well, do you think like a kid would watch Fear next week and think that's just like my childhood?
Right. Well, what I thought was
that's a little different example.
I've got a kid who's 13, and the thought of letting him just go out and be gone overnight with three other buddies staying in the woods.
Yeah.
You know, like the way he's making it out
there's
of there.
No way.
Oh, no. The movie that we talked about was A Christmas Story, which was mm-hmm. came out in 83 and was set in like 19, what, 40? 40?
Yeah.
Right.
Before the war?
40-ish. Yeah. 39, yeah. 40.
But so we realized that if you were to set a movie like that now, it would have taken a place in about 1983.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which just that time span is so hard to like. Right. Grasp. You think in 83 how different the 40s were, and it's just crazy.
Yeah, whereas that different, but that's the thing, is the difference between those, like, you know, 80 to, you know, Christmas Story, and if you went modern day back that same amount, they're just I feel like they're way different.
Right. I do think that they're not in our formative years, you know. I mean, those were our formative years. So they, you know, 1 year back then was like, you know, 7 or 8 now, you know. I mean, you can blink your eyes and, you know, 8 years go by. Back then, it was like, you know, every week was huge, something new and something exciting.
Right. So, if you guys want, we can jump into the last list here.
Yep.
Yes. If you guys want, I'll go last, because I want to hear what yours are first.
Okay.
I'll go first.
Go ahead.
So I added 2 to this just during this because of things that first of all, here, I have 2 honorable mentions. So there's a movie in like 2005 called Secret Window with Johnny Depp. I don't think I liked it all that much, but I saw it. It was okay. In fact, I remember going to that movie, Dave, me and Kim and Sonia, the three of us went to that movie. Yeah, I don't know where you were, but the three of us like went out for dinner and went to that movie on this night. It was, I remember that. And then I'm not a huge fan of The Shining. I mean, I'd watch it again. It just, when I first watched it, I didn't feel like it hit me like it does. You know, some people would say it's like the greatest, you know, horror movie, whatever. Yeah. So I put those off my list.
By the way, Stephen King famously does not like that movie.
Oh,
he hates what Stanley Kubrick did to it.
Mm-hmm. So my number five, I've only seen it one or two times. And if I saw it twice, they were very close to each other. But I remember really liking Dolores Claiborne with Kathy Bates. And is Julia Roberts in that? Is that who it is?
I don't remember. That is a book and a movie I've never seen.
You've never seen it?
Nope.
Number four, I didn't have it on here, but I just realized I should add Stand By Me. That's my fourth one.
There you go.
Number three, I got The Green Mile. Number two, I have Shawshank because I had forgotten about, or I didn't really realize it, but that's one of my favorite movies. And then I saved number one for the movie that I feel like is more of a Stephen King. I actually read the book.
Can I guess it?
Hang on. I actually read the book.
No.
And I love the movie. And I feel like it's the best representative of his stuff for me. And what is it, Dave?
So this might be the first book I ever read of his, because I think it might be the first book I ever read. Is it Pet Sematary?
No.
Oh, all right.
It's Misery.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. All right.
I love that movie. I read that book. And, you know, that's it. Unlike a novella or some of these that were part of like a collection or whatever, that's like more, I think, a true Stephen King one. So that's why I put it in number one.
Doesn't Kim really like Pet Sematary?
Maybe. I had that on my list at first as just to mention, because we did watch it once.
Okay.
I don't remember if she actually really liked it that much or if she remembered it better than she did, but
I feel like I thought I heard her one time say that she really liked that. That's why I thought that might be.
She probably did say that.
Okay.
But you were wrong, Dave.
Yeah. Won't be the last time.
I'll go next. My number five, I think, Dave, is going to make you laugh, but it was one that was on all the time.
Can I guess it? Sure.
Can I guess it?
Maximum Overdrive.
That's right. Exactly.
Yes.
Cult favorite.
It was on all the time.
Right around the same time this did. Yeah. And Stephen King directed Maximum Overdrive.
I thought it was a little bit earlier, but it was just, the whole movie is just ridiculous. I remember I watched it all the time when I was a kid. It was on like HBO.
Yep.
One of our other favorite podcasts is How Did This Get Made? And that episode they made about this movie is just freaking hilarious. But
a sprinkler is not a machine.
Right. And then my number four, I had Misery, which Brad, you've already mentioned. I had Green Mile as my three, Stand By Me as my two, and Shawshank as my number one.
Yeah, excellent. I figured they'd be pretty similar there.
Yep. Yeah.
You didn't have Maximum Overdrive, though.
No, but he didn't. What was that, four out of the five?
Have you ever even seen it, Brad?
No, I don't know that one.
Oh, okay.
It's his all these direct directorial debut.
It makes me think, I had to look up to see, though, Steven Spielberg's first movie was Duel, and I had to look up and see, was that a Stephen King book? Because it feels like a Stephen King like story. And I really like that movie. Like, I've seen that on TV a few times, and that's just like such an interesting thing to get sucked into.
Getting chased by a mysterious semi.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I got a couple honorable mentions. The movie Dreamcatcher, I was a fan of. Dave's laughing, of course.
That's another one I've never read and I've never seen, but that is another How Did This Get Made movie.
Some good.
That is known for being written during Stephen King's heavy drug phase.
Sure, I could see that.
Because it was right after his accident, and so he is, like, totally on Vicodin the entire book.
But I love the actors in it. Damian Lewis, you know, this is shortly after Band of Brothers.
Yep.
Timothy Oliphant, Jason Lee, and Thomas Jane, like those, you know, like all four of those guys. So I enjoyed that, and it's got, you know, some fun alien stuff in it. I remember the three-part miniseries on TV with The Stand scared the living crap out of me when I was younger and saw that. So my number five.
It wasn't on NBC.
Exactly. My number five, another movie that Thomas Jane was in, The Mist. The end of that movie is absolutely heart-wrenching.
Oh, the way I just that... recently watched it for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
My God. Yeah. Yeah.
Tough.
Oof.
Tough way to end it. I recommend watching it.
Have I seen that? What is The Mist? Is it, how old is it?
They're in like a grocery store and there's this mist that's got all these like crazy creatures.
I have seen it.
Yeah.
Yep. That's it's a tough good. Ending. I liked it. Yeah. I liked it.
It's a good movie. It's depressing.
Yeah. I think I get it confused with the horrible movie, The Happening.
Another one called The Fog.
Yeah, and
The Happening is that Mark Wahlberg.
M. Night Shyamalan. Yeah. Oh, God, does that suck.
Yeah.
My number four is The Shining. Number three, another movie that scared the crap out of me when it was on TV when I was a kid, It. The original. My God, for scaring the crap out of me.
Yep.
I love, by the way, I mean, it's kind of a gimmick now, but every Halloween there is one house down the street that has a storm sewer. And they
storm sewer with the red balloon.
And they put a little clown inside.
A little balloon.
Now.
God, just makes my skin crawl like that. Oh, man, so scary. My number two is The Green Mile. And my number one is The Shawshank Redemption, because that is one of the greatest movies of all time. And based on a novella from 1982.
Yeah. So I've got a couple of different things here. I do have one thing that I'm going to throw out as an honorable mention. It is. So if I think about why I was excited about that, it was Stephen King. When I got into the theater and saw it was based on one of his stories. I have two movies that I know I would have seen at this point that were movies I loved when I was a kid. One is like the first time I truly remember being terrified at a sleepover to the point where I could not sleep that night and I did not want anyone to know that I was this affected, but Children of the Corn.
Okay.
Oh, they're, yeah.
Never watched the whole thing.
It's not a great movie. If you watch it today, it very much is like a Maximum Overdrive type thing.
When it was on TV, I would avoid it.
Courtney always talks about how when she would go to sleepovers, that's what they would watch, but she would fall asleep, so she never saw the whole movie.
I found it back then to be absolutely terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
The other one that I love to this day, and it's one I actually have shown my kids, is Creepshow. I love how Creepshow is like little short. So one of my favorite things with Stephen King is he's got a lot of great short story compilations.
Anthology type
stuff.
Yeah,
he's so good at. And so that's the thing is, like, to me, that it's supposed to be like a little comic book and it's got all these little stories in it. And I still to this day, I love it, you know, and it's very Tales of the Cryptish.
Yep, or Tales exactly, of the, yep. Yeah.
And so as I get into my top five, I would actually have this Stand By Me as my number five, which is kind of, I mean, given it's one of my favorite movies, everything that's above it has more to do with all like, you know, book and movie. So number four for me is It. And that has so much more to do though with the book versus the TV series or the new movies.
Mm-hmm.
I like both of those. But for me, when I say like Stephen King's really good at writing kids and bullies, this is the book for that.
Mm-hmm.
The kids in there, they're called the Losers Club.
Yep.
When I was a little kid and I was reading this, I read it probably way, way before it was appropriate for me. I just love the kids in this book. And so I kind of like really identified or appreciated that they were all kind of outsiders.
Sure.
Number three for me would be The Shining. And that's a combination between the book, but so the other movie I would have seen before Stand By Me, and it was one where I find this totally bizarre now. If you guys like The Shining, I still like it. I still watch it every once in a while. I think I've watched it twice in the last year. And I do like the movie, but it is slow.
Yeah.
It's a slow movie. For whatever reason, when we were like, you know, 8, 9 or whatever. Like the most popular kid in my group had a sleepover and watched it at his birthday. So I remember me personally, I went back and I told my mom, we have to watch The Shining. Like, you have to let us watch The Shining at my birthday. And sure. I had a sleepover and we watched it there. I bet I went to four or five birthday parties where we watched this at a sleepover. And we were all like obsessed with Jack Nicholson in the movie. And I think back to it now and I go, how weird that this group of like 8 to 10, you know, third to fourth grade age boys wanted to watch this slow multi-hour drama of a guy like going insane. Yep. Like, just very strange.
Yeah.
So my number two, I combined the two Frank Darabont movies, Shawshank, Green Mile. Mm-hmm. To me, The Green Mile is one of the best reads for Stephen King. But my number one, and it's his biggest series, is a 7-book series called The Dark Tower. The first book, and it's called The Gunslinger. Yeah. I love this series so much. It's so weird. I would not, this would be something I'd be hesitant to recommend to other people, but I have read these to my kids. We have like a bond over it, but I like, there's things about it. I don't even want to get into describing what it is, like what the series is, because it's so bonkers to anyone that wouldn't know what mm-hmm. it's about. But this is like one of the biggest like entertainment things for me, just period.
Sure.
So that's it.
Excellent.
All right. Hey, Giffrey, you know who the best coming of age group of four guys is?
Preacher Roll.
Yeah, that's right.
Well done. Way to shoehorn that in there.
Well, we should have played the damn Yankees song, Coming of Age. That's a classic.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
All right. But standing on my own.
Let's hear some Preacher Roll.
Okay.
Hey, thanks for listening, guys.
Bye, guys.
I'm scared, but there's nothing I can do.